Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, your weekly analysis of what's happening in our economy and the world economy. Jobs, incomes, debts, future prospects, all of that. I'm Richard Wolff, your host. Been a professor of economics all my adult life. Currently, I teach at the New School University in New York City. And I also write regular columns for a variety of publications, but particularly truthout.org. That is a remarkable independent source of news and analysis that I urge you to check out at truthout.org. If you're interested in what this program does, the analyses we offer, the documents we refer to, the facts we examine, then you will also be interested and make use of our two websites. They are available 24/7, no charge whatsoever. The first one is rdwolf.com, and the other one is democracyatwork.info. Both of those websites also offer you two other benefits. The first is a way to communicate with us here in the program, to suggest ways we can do better, to offer criticisms, pose questions, and so on. Since we get many more emails than we can answer, please understand if we cannot reply to yours beyond a formality, because we simply can't. We select a few questions to answer at the end of each program, but we read every email you send us to help shape what this program does. And the other thing that two websites offer you is a way to follow us on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest. Just click on the icon, and then you will be in touch with us on a more ongoing basis, which we invite you to do. So let me turn to the updates for this September 2014. The first one has to do with new information from the Census Bureau, but it confirms a number of long-term trends that are changing and shaping our economy, and so they're appropriate for us to talk to. The Census Bureau released last week information on households in the United States, different kinds of households and how they're set up. And here are just some of the really fascinating bits of information that this reveals and what it might mean for the economy. First, and perhaps most dramatic, do most Americans grow up in a household in which children live with their married parents? Sort of what you might call the traditional or typical household. The answer is a resounding no. According to the Census Bureau, in 2012, the last year for which we have numbers, 19.6% of households were married couples with children. Less than one-fifth. Over 80% of Americans live in households that are not married couples with children. How was it back in 1970? 40 years ago, 40.3% of Americans then lived in households of married couples with children. So the number of those kinds of households, which was less than half back in 1970, is now less than one-fifth. The vast majority of Americans do not live in that kind of household. Even more interesting to me was the number of households that consist of a man or a woman living alone. There the changes have been spectacular. First, in 2012, the number of households that contained either a man or a woman living alone was 27.5%, much more than the number of households in which you had a married couple with children. And that has grown dramatically, more than doubled since 1970. So people living alone in a household is rapidly growing and is now much larger than the number of households that have married couples with children. What has not changed are married couples without children. There's about 30% of us live in that kind of a household. Married couple, no children. And that's what it was back in the 1970s. So that's been kind of stable. Other big growth areas, families not composed of a married couple, with and without children. That's also a rapidly growing collect. People who are not married, but living together with or without children. So that's changing. And of course, that has enormous consequences. People living alone have different patterns of spending their money than people living in couples. And that means a different pattern of what is purchased and what isn't. What kind of company succeeds, what kind of company doesn't. We'll have more to say in later programs about all the implications, but it is something that is changing in America, and it is something worth thinking about. The next update has to do with the little city of Somerset, Kentucky. Why would I be talking about it? Well, let's tell you a little bit about it. It's a city in Kentucky that has 11,000 residents, so it's a mid-size or smallish city. It's near a very popular tourist location called Lake Cumberland. It has a mayor who's a member of the Republican Party by the name of Eddie Girdler. So far, it's like many other cities in America, but here comes why it's on the program. It's very different, it turns out, from many other cities. Why? The city of Somerset was upset that its residents had to pay the high gasoline prices to operate their cars and trucks, and they decided to do something about it. So the city decided to approach a gasoline wholesaler and buy a huge quantity of gasoline from that wholesaler. And when you buy a huge quantity, in this case, $200,000 worth, that's a lot of gas, you get a much better price than what you would pay if you fill up your tank at the local gas station. So the city spent $200,000 to buy the gas. It spent $75,000 to buy the pumps and the storage facility. And then it said it was going to turn around and offer the gasoline at only a very tiny bit more than the lower price it paid. In other words, it would cover the costs of the building and the little bit of labor and so forth to manage all of this, but the end result would be gasoline significantly cheaper per gallon at the city's pumps than what had to be paid at the private gasoline stations peppered around the city. Wow, what an interesting idea. You can imagine, of course, that the people of Somerset were thrilled. The 11,000 people now had much cheaper gas, which they need. What's more, the city, because it offered these low gas prices at the city's gas, city-owned gas pumps, was leading tourists on their way to Lake Cumberland to make a stop in Somerset to get the cheap gas and, of course, along the way, buy some potato chips and maybe stop for a sandwich, etc. So Somerset was really doing well. A few gas stations weren't doing so well because they were losing customers to the city. But the number of people helped in this way was huge, and the number of people hurt in this way was minimal. You can imagine what the gas companies and their associations, the Kentucky Grocers Association, the Petroleum Marketers Association, the Kentucky Association of Convenience Stores, they yelled. This is socialism, they said. Well, you might wonder, what did Mayor Girdler, a Republican, do when charged with doing this kind of socialist program where the government takes over buying and reselling gasoline for the benefit of his 11,000 residents? I'm going to quote to you what Mayor Girdler said. Quote, "If government doesn't do it to protect the public, then who does it?" he asked. In response to reporters' questions, he made the following statement. Please listen to this, because a Republican mayor said what I'm about to read. "It's the role of government to protect us from big business." Oh, wow. Now, for those of you that are interested in this story, a little reminder. In the history of the United States, these kinds of activities are not rare. although it hasn't been true for quite a while, as we have wobbled as a nation over into the notion that only if the private sector does it is it done well. We didn't believe that as a nation for many, many, many years, and that was based on good, hard experience. In the history of the United States, public communities have bought and resold electricity to save money. Indeed, 2,000 cities across the United States do that right now. That's right. 2,000 cities across the United States do not permit electric utilities to set prices and take out of their citizens whatever they want. Instead, they buy bulk electricity and resell it to city residents, saving huge amounts on electric bills. 2,000 cities do for electricity what Somerset, Kentucky just did for gasoline. And cities around the United States have done that at various times for all kinds of things. It used to even have a name, used to be called municipal socialism. That's because people have identified the word socialist with the notion that the government is doing something. On this program, I've explained many times that that's one definition of socialism, but by far not the only one, or not even nowadays the main one. But nonetheless, it's an interesting idea. The Republican mayor of Somerset defends it by using government to protect people from big business. So here's a question I leave you with if this story of Somerset, Kentucky interests you. Why not extend this activity? Here's a thought. Maybe the town or the city ought to own and operate its own bank, gathering everybody's deposits and making loans available to local individuals and businesses, particularly small businesses, on better terms than they can now get from private banks, particularly when so many of them are branches of monster banks that are international. There is something called the Public Banking Institute and the public banking movement that thinks you ought to do that. And as I've told you on this program, the state of North Dakota for the last 100 years has done precisely that. The Bank of North Dakota is a government-owned and operated bank that collects all of the money that the state has, which it deposits in that bank, which in turn can make loans to citizens and businesses of North Dakota on much more favorable terms than they could get from big banks. And Republicans and Democrats have defended and protected the Bank of North Dakota from all the charges of socialism for 100 years. But think further. Why doesn't a community open and operate supermarkets? Why doesn't a community own and operate furniture stores, department stores? The principle of buying in quantity and getting the goods much more cheaply and then minimally reselling them to your population so that the whole population gets the benefit of what a city can do by buying in bulk is something that ought to be thought about by many, especially as the United States keeps wallowing in the hard times of this economic crisis. The next update has to do with wage theft. A report by the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, released on the 11th of September, 2014, produced by Brady Maxell and Ross Eisenbray, documents wage theft in America. And what does that mean? It means paying workers less than the wages they are legally entitled to, making them work overtime without really paying them overtime rates, making them work technically, quote, off the clock without being paid, and so on. Here's what the report, using FBI information, reports. And I'm going to use the most stunning statistic. They compared the amount of money stolen by employers through wage theft, not properly paying their workers, to the amount of money stolen in all the robberies, burglaries, larcenies, and motor vehicle thefts in the entire country. Okay? Wow. In 2012, there were 292,000 robberies of all kinds. Bank robberies, residential robberies, convenience store and gas station robberies, and street robberies. The total value of the property taken in these robberies was $340 million. The total amount of wage theft in 2012, 3 times larger. We give a lot of attention to robbery when it takes that dramatic form that can make it onto a TV show. Much less dramatic, but much more important economically, is the robbery perpetrated on employees by employers in the United States. And there's a much less of a prosecution effort because of the difficulty of identifying it and because of the hesitancy of workers to report it for fear that they will lose their jobs, etc., etc. Next update, I want to tell you about another small area, this time not Somerset, Kentucky, but Stonington, Maine. Something extraordinary happened in Stonington, Maine in recent weeks, and it deserves some attention. A couple had had 3 stores in that small community for 40 years, Vern and Sandra Seil. And they decided they couldn't do this anymore, and they tried to sell the Burnt Cove Market, the V&S Variety and Pharmacy, and the Galley Restaurant in Stonington, Maine. They couldn't find a commercial buyer, and they were afraid that these businesses might go out of the business or be taken over by somebody far away who wouldn't have the interest of the community at heart. So guess what they did? They decided, together with their workers, numbering 62 people, to turn these 3 businesses over to a worker cooperative that would run them as cooperatives, as a group. These 62 residents of Maine, Stonington, Maine in the Maine, got together and have organized a workers' co-op. It is now the largest workers' co-op in the state of Maine. And it is a way of preserving a community, preserving a bunch of jobs, and in a sense, starting anew. The workers are very excited. They were worried in the beginning that they couldn't do it, and they discovered, and this is why I'm telling you this story, that there are all kinds of organizations in Maine, in New England, and I'm telling you, my audience, all over the United States and in Canada, there are all kinds of institutions and organizations that help new co-ops get off the ground, with technical assistance, with low-interest loans, with all kinds of facilities to help this happen. Worker co-ops were crucial for the survival of Stonington, for the protection of these 62 families, these workers and their families. It was a solution better than going out of business, selling to an absentee corporation. It is something for everyone who listens to this program to think about. Finally, and quickly, there is a measurement economists make that I want to bring to your attention. It has a funny name, liquid asset poor. Here's what it means. It measures how much money families have that they can tap quickly. In other words, how much cash savings do they have in the bank, if any? How much stocks, if they have any, that they could sell quickly and get the money? How much in the way of a retirement account that they could go into and take money out of? How much money do they have? And the reason this is looked into is that all kinds of emergencies afflict families. These are not questions of their fault. This is a disease. It could be a divorce. It could be some kind of disaster in the area that interrupts or prevents people from getting to work. All kinds of things can happen like that that are nobody particular's fault, but that can be an emergency problem for a family. And according to the United States government and many studies, a family needs to keep a minimum of $6,000. That's the estimate. For a family of 4, if they're at the poverty level, to get through such an emergency. Typically, for And in the other family, the government calculates you need to have 3 months' worth of your income available as cash money you can turn to in order to survive an emergency, in order to make sure that an emergency doesn't plunge you into a poverty you may never emerge from. The Corporation for Enterprise Development. I'll say the name again if you would like to look it up and see this report in detail. The Corporation for Enterprise Development last week released a report that said that about half of the American people don't have that much money. That is, they don't have saved 3 months of income, which means they could not weather any emergency financially if it fell upon them. And if we're talking half of our people, that's millions of people who are going to face emergencies in the months and years ahead and will not be able to manage them financially. Half. In some places, it's much more. Detroit, 68%. Miami, 67%. Cleveland, 65%. That's two-thirds of the families can't manage it. One of the ways to measure an economic system that is not working well for its people is if you have half to two-thirds of your population in a situation where the kinds of emergencies that are part of life could cripple you financially for an indefinite period of time. That's an economic system that isn't serving the needs of its people. So much for the short updates. Let's turn now, as we always do, to some larger topics. Well, last week, Janet Yellen, the head of the Federal Reserve System, held some meetings and gave a press conference and testimony at its end. What did she say? The Federal Reserve is going to keep interest rates low, she said, very, very low, just barely above zero. And why? Because the economic system we're in, it's too dangerous to raise interest rates. Why? Well, if you raise interest rates, you make it more expensive to borrow. If you make it more expensive to borrow, then people thinking about buying a car will have to think again because they can't afford payments that are higher because the interest is higher. People thinking of buying a home by taking out a mortgage will think again. In other words, if the Federal Reserve raises interest rates, it's going to slow down an economy. And since we still have an economy which for the mass of people is in very tough shape, she does not dare raise interest rates. That's what she announced. And I want to make sure you understand that's an admission by the highest financial authorities in this country that the economy we're in, about which we hear endless uses of the word recovery, hasn't. Not for the mass of people, and therefore it's too dangerous to stop making money available to our biggest banks at virtually no cost, an interest rate barely above zero. What that, of course, means is that the government, the Federal Reserve, has to keep pumping money into the economy. This worries all the conservatives and others about what is going to happen with all that money if and when it starts chasing goods. That's when it drives up prices. So what she had to say to them is, well, we're going to keep the interest rates low, but when we finally raise them, we may raise them faster than you had thought we might. Well, this is PR, this is politics. The bottom line is the economy is in too fragile shape to risk raising interest rates. The next topic I want to talk about is gentrification. Many of you have asked me to do that, so I'm going to talk about it. First, what does it mean? Basically, it means when a poor neighborhood where the housing has not been maintained real well, where very poor people have lived for a long time, so that the streets look a bit run down, the housing isn't maintained, things like that. Many, many communities have neighborhoods that are described that way. Gentrification is the word we use to describe what happens when wealthy people or upper middle class people begin to move into that kind of a neighborhood. And then it changes. So I want to talk about the economics first. What is typically necessary for gentrification to happen is that a nearby area becomes expensive. People gather to live there, whether it's because it's an urban area where people want to gather these days, or because it's beautiful by a river, or has a lovely view on a mountain, whatever it is. People gather in an area that becomes expensive and the home of well-heeled folks. And then they run out of space, or the prices in those places for real estate, for an apartment, for a home, become so expensive that people who want to live there can't. They can't afford it, or there literally is no space. So they have to go nearby. The idea is, as close as possible, find an area that's poor, that's been poor for a while, where the housing is inexpensive because it's only for poor people who couldn't have afforded it. Go in, buy a house or land cheaply, and then use your money to improve the housing, to renovate, to build new apartments, and so on. When that happens, when a poor neighborhood is invaded by the wealthier folks nearby looking for a way to be near the center of fun but not pay the price, we call that gentrification. It is visible in many, many American cities and even in some suburban areas. What I want to stress about it is this is an example of the market working. And so let's see how it works. First, it means that the homes of poor people that they have lived in often for generations are suddenly interesting to people who have more money than they do. The people with more money than they do approach the landlords, those who own the buildings, and they say to them, "We will pay you more if you let us have the apartment than you're now getting from those poor people." And the landlord, normally in our society, rubs his hands together and says, "Oh, great." And then proceeds, one way or another, legally or illegally, to push the poor people out of the neighborhood. This can take the form that when the lease expires, doubling the rent or tripling the rent. In most American cities, the landlord is free to do that. And even where there are rent controls or rent stabilization programs, as in New York City, for example, there are a variety of ways landlords have found to pressure tenants, poor tenants, to leave. And so gentrification means the expulsion of poor people, middle-income people, anyone who can't match the offer of higher rent that the folks coming in from the wealthier neighborhoods nearby are prepared to spend. And here's a fantastic irony. When this happens, you get a whole expulsion of people who have lived in these nearby neighborhoods, as I say, often for generations. They're forced out. They have to find housing somewhere else. No one cares whether they have young children or not. No one cares what the community is that they built there, what local facilities they helped to develop for the community. Nobody cares. Gentrification sweeps all that aside and says, if you've got more money, you get to live there. And if you don't have enough money, you're out of here. It's harsh. It's cruel. It's how the market works. But now the irony. One of the things that happens is that as more affluent people move in, as the poorer folk are pushed away, it makes it more known in the affluent community that this is happening. Particularly young people starting out say, "Oh, this is a way we can solve our problem of limited money, but we want to live in a nice neighborhood, etc., etc." So what starts as a trickle of gentrification becomes a flood of gentrification. And pretty soon, as more and more of the well-heeled folk come in to what was once a poor neighborhood, it isn't a poor neighborhood anymore. It becomes more and more expensive, and pretty soon the people who want a nice place to live in a chic community have to go further and further afield so that the gentrification spreads. Final irony. as all these people become settled in these now fancier, gentrified neighborhoods, they need all kinds of servants. People to take care of their kids, people to walk the dog, people to work in the dry cleaner to whom they take their clothes, people to work in the restaurants that they want to be able to go to, and all of that. And so they bring in these little businesses, low-income workers, because they want to be profitable, often immigrants. They have to live somewhere. So another part of town becomes the living area for the servants of the gentrified neighborhoods, until the people in the gentrified neighborhood want to move again, and then you can see it doing that, and they push out their own servants, who then have to live further and further away. It produces not a diverse community, but a homogenized community. It produces not a variety of people living and working together, but it produces uniformity. Everybody of a certain level of income, thrown out. Everybody above that, welcome. It produces a growing distance between rich and poor that ramifies throughout our society and raises deep questions about holding this kind of country together when it is separating apart. But that doesn't matter, because the market dictates, and the market is a cruel master. It produces division when that may not be in what the society needs at all. In that case, the market gets you an outcome that is not what society needs and wants. Questions about the market that should be debated everywhere. We're now going to take our mid-program break. We will be gone for a very short time. This is Richard Wolff, an economic update. Please join me again when we resume for the second half of today's program. Welcome back. This is Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update. I want to remind you again that we maintain these two websites where the kinds of analysis you hear here are in abundant available for you at no charge whatsoever, 24/7. The first one is rdwolff with two Fs .com, and the second one is democracyatwork.info. Both of those websites will also offer you a way to communicate with us, your thoughts, your criticisms, your questions, and finally, by clicking on the relevant icon to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. Continuing sort of our major discussions, I wanted to talk today about one of the consequences of the widening gap between rich and poor that many commentators have not observed or spoken about, and yet is very, very important. Let me explain it at first in the simplest way I know how. Basically, in our society, middle-income people and lower-income people are doing very badly. More and more of the income generated in our economy is going to the richest 5, 10, 20%. In other words, the people, the vast majority in the middle and the bottom, are having less and less money to spend relative to those at the top. Why is this important in a way that hasn't been discussed? Because this growing gap has severe and serious tax implications. Let me explain. If you are middle and lower income, you basically have to pay all your taxes because they're withheld from your paycheck. They're paid automatically on your behalf. At the end of the year, if you owe a little extra, you pay. If you have a refund coming, you get it back. But the taxes are taken out of you kind of automatically. If the income you earn, either because many of you are unemployed or because many of you have an income that's been stagnant, if that income isn't going up, in fact, if it's going down, then the tax revenue of the community is not going anywhere, or maybe even going down. At the same time, if more and more income goes to the top, that money does not pay taxes at the top the way it does in the middle. Why? Because people at the top don't earn most of their money in the form of a paycheck from which taxes are withheld. The people at the top earn dividends. They earn interest. They get capital gains on their stocks when they buy them at one price and sell them at a higher price. So people at the top earn money that doesn't have taxes withheld. Number two, people at the top have the money to hire the lawyers, the specialized tax accountants, whose job it is to find every conceivable loophole in the tax laws, which run hundreds of pages, to enable those who hire them to escape the taxes that they would otherwise have to pay. And there is every study imaginable to show that the wealthy folks' ability to hire specialized advisors to get them out of paying taxes are very adept at doing that. And I'm not even going to go into the ways that very wealthy folks have of hiding their wealth out of the United States and escaping taxation that way, etc., etc. Bottom line, in a society where the rich and the poor are getting further apart, where more and more of the wealth is in the hands of those at the top, less and less in the way of income taxes are going to be received by the federal, the state, or the local governments, pinching what they can do. Even further, though, here's another example. Middle and low income people getting less and less of the income means that they have less and less of the money available to spend. They hold back on spending because they're fearful. Their jobs are insecure. Their futures are insecure. Their savings have run out. They try to rebuild those savings. So they don't spend as much money, which means sales tax revenues drop. Most states in the United States depend on sales tax revenues. Meanwhile, the very wealthy people, precisely because they are wealthy, spend a much smaller amount of their money in the first place, so they're not going to increase the sales taxes to offset what the middle and lower income people aren't spending. Bottom line, governments, particularly state governments, get less in the way of sales tax revenue. Well, what does that mean? It means that state government and federal government and local government are pinched not only by the economic crisis and the big unemployment, that's already bad, but on top of it by the growing gap between rich and poor, which severely shrinks the tax revenues cities and towns have. So what have they done? Well, most states in the United States have therefore cut the services that they provide to their citizens. The irrationality of this is stupefying. We're in an economic crisis. The private sector has reduced pensions, reduced benefits, reduced jobs, made the pay go nowhere. People are therefore in more need of government services than they've been in decades. Just as the need of the people for more is clear, the government cuts those services. That's not a system that's working well, and that's as polite a way as I know of how to say that. What else have governments done? A few, and I'm going to mention the most impressive, California, Connecticut, New York, and New Jersey, a few have raised sales tax levels. That's not good. But they have at least also raised the tax on very wealthy people to try to begin to offset the very effect I'm describing to you. But in total in the United States, out of 50 states, only 11 have even raised a little bit the tax on millionaires, the tax on the very wealthy. The other 39 states haven't done it at all. And if you don't raise the tax on the rich, you either are going to raise taxes on everybody else, which worsens their situation, or you're going to cut services, which worsens most people's situation. That's what most states have done. A couple have taken a very interesting step. Colorado and Washington legalized marijuana and tax it heavily, and have explained in part why they did that, precisely to deal with the growing gap between rich and poor. How interesting. Conservatives who tend to defend and excuse a growing gap between rich and poor now have to confront the fact that the marijuana they wanted to keep illegal is becoming legal because it's a way of raising taxes that are down precisely because of the growing inequality. Last major discussion today may surprise you. I want to talk a little bit about beer, the beer industry, because it teaches us very important lessons about what's happening in the American economy, and that's what this program is about. Beer is now a highly concentrated industry. What that means is, looking at the whole planet we live on, the globe, very few companies have captured an enormous portion of the entire world's beer market. Roughly half of all the beer produced in the world is produced by five companies. And I'm very briefly going to tell you who they are and what this means. The fifth largest is China Resources Snow Breweries. That's right. The fifth largest beer producer in the world is now a Chinese company. It is the top selling beer in the world. Its brand there, very famous, called CR Snow. But partly it's the largest beer producer brand in the world because that's the brand sold in China, and China has the largest population in the world. But in terms of the whole world, it's the fifth largest company. Fourth largest, bigger than the Chinese company, fourth largest, is the Carlsberg Group, that some of you may know because they're the producers in Denmark, that's where this company is based, of Carlsberg beer. But they have also become larger by buying other brands, some of which I want to let you know about. Tuborg beer is owned by Carlsberg. Kronenbourg beer, and literally hundreds of other beers and beer names are actually owned by Carlsberg. It alone, for example, has 40% of the Russian market for beer. Third biggest company, Belgian. It's the Heineken Corporation, that I'm sure many of you know the name. They are the third largest producer of beer in the world. They, in 2014, it owned 190 breweries located in over 70 countries. To tell you some of the brands that they own their what used to be their largest competitor, Amstel, that's owned by Heineken. They also own Scottish and Newcastle. It's extraordinary. They brew and sell over 170 brands of beers, and they are a global competitor. The second largest beer company in the world is S.A.B. Miller. S.A.B. Miller. This company was originally founded in South Africa. S.A.B. standing for South African Breweries or South African Beer. They grew systematically, and in 2002, they bought the Miller Brewing Company here in the United States. And so they changed their name to S.A.B. Miller. S.A.B. Miller. It has operations now in 75 countries. It includes over 150 brands, including beverages such as Carling Black Label, Milwaukee's Best, Castle, Grolsch. S.A.B. Miller is also one of the largest bottlers of Coca-Cola in the world. And now we come to number one. Number one. Anheuser-Busch InBev, based, oh, by the way, S.A.B. Miller is based in London, the second number two, and the number one is based in Belgium. Again, Belgium. Anheuser-Busch in Belgium. That's, so the five biggest companies are all not American. These are companies based and controlled abroad. Let me finish with Anheuser-Busch. It is an enormous company, the number one company, as I said. It has many, many labels. The ones that are most familiar, probably to my listeners, are Budweiser, Bud Light, Beck's, Skoll, Alexander Keith, and so on. Why am I telling you all of this? Well, first, I want you to see the concentration that is happening in all of industry. We once had industries that were different in Alabama from Pennsylvania, in Nebraska from Oregon. But those eventually, with the growth of the United States, became national companies. Now, the formation of national out-of-state companies is becoming international. Beer is now an internationally produced and distributed commodity. Five non-American companies control it. Why is that important? Well, I guess the best way to tell it, is to remind everybody what happened when the number one, InBev in Belgium, bought out Anheuser-Busch. That happened in 2008. Since that time, employee benefits have been cut. The beer, by many people's description, is not what it once was. The profits are higher, but this global company looks upon the United States as the place where 5% of the world's population lives, and no matter how much beer they buy, that's way less than the rest of the world. And these companies' eyes are on the big picture, the global market. That's where they're focused. And if that means moving breweries out of the United States because it's too expensive to pay workers here and moving them to any one of the 70-odd companies most of these big corporations work in, they have. And if they haven't, they will. It puts the United States less and less in the forefront. In this little corner of the beer industry, we can see the globalization of corporate control that will have its lasting effects because the United States does not interfere in what these corporations are doing. Something to think about. In the final 15 minutes or so, or actually less that we have, I'm going to respond to one of your questions, actually to several of them, if time allows me to do that. Okay, first, many of you have written to me, is it only the retail and fast food workers that we hear about in the press that are pushing for a $15 minimum wage? And the answer is no. And I want to give you an example of how the struggle for a $15 an hour wage has already inspired and moved other workers in other situations to push for the same. The first and most interesting example are workers at the Los Angeles airport who pushed for a higher minimum wage and got it. In fact, the minimum wage at the Los Angeles airport now is $15.84 per hour for those who don't have benefits. If you get a bunch of benefits, they can pay you a bit less. So they've been successful. And I recently learned and want to pass on to you that workers at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport are now organized and seeking a $15 an hour minimum wage there. In other words, the question, will the movement of fast food workers and others for $15 an hour inspire workers elsewhere, has been answered. Yes, it will. It already has. Of course, the business community is screaming. And one of the arguments they make is worth a rebuttal here and now. The argument is, if you have to pay workers more, that will drive up the price of, say, airplane rides. The answer to that is that it's a person who has never studied or if they studied, never learned economics. When a cost goes up, whether it be the cost of labor or the cost of materials or any other cost, that does not automatically enable or translate into the enterprise raising its price. Any person who actually runs an enterprise knows that, because you may not be able to raise your price. You're not going to raise your price, whether or not you have higher costs, you're not going to raise your price if it hurts your bottom line. If the number of people who stop buying what you sell when you raise the price is significant, you're not going to do it. You know what's going to happen? You're going to have to absorb the rising cost, keep your prices the same. And you know what that'll do? That'll eat into your profits. And that's what they're angry about. Not that the rising cost of the wage will mean that they raise the price and the poor consumer will have to pay more. They want you to think like that because they hope the big mass of consumers will block the workers from getting higher wages. Don't be fooled. Workers' wages can go up and the price of an airline ticket will stay the same because it's too dangerous for the airline companies to raise the prices because customers won't come. So they won't. And their profits will be hurt. That's why they're screaming. But why should workers forgo a minimum wage that's the minimum to live decently just to preserve the high profits of their employers? Second question, and this is cute. One of you wrote to me, and I really appreciate it, saying, look, isn't there a contradiction? We're supposed to believe, according to the courts and the Supreme Court in the United States, that corporations are persons. We're to think about a corporation as having freedom of speech, like the Hobby Lobby and other cases. And individuals and corporations are equally free to speak. How interesting, then, that if an American citizen goes abroad, he or she still has to pay income here in the United States, even though they're living elsewhere for a while. But a corporation can go, like Burger King to Canada, arrange for 20% of its shares to be owned, in this case, by Canadians, and suddenly they become a foreign corporation not subject to American taxes. If corporations are individuals and persons, this questioner writes, here's a case where they're not being treated the same. And if they're going to have the same freedom of speech rights, why wouldn't they have the same? Well, a person doesn't have shares in himself or herself. Fine. Then create a way for a person to do that and become a foreigner in order to be equal. There's something not quite fair here, isn't there? And my response to the questioner is, you've put your finger right on it, and don't let go of the irony of what you've pointed out. The next question concerns the BRICS Bank. Let me tell you what that is. BRICS is a name now used to refer to the following: Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Large, independent, quote-unquote, third world-like countries. Not as rich as the big, developed Western European, North American, but up and coming with strong economies on many levels. The BRICS, they're called. And what they recently decided, that caused quite a furor, is that they're not happy with the pattern of lending from the World Bank and from Western-based banks in general. They think that the banks based in North America, Western Europe, and Japan favor those regions, discriminate against up-and-coming economies like the BRICS, give them fewer loans, charge them more for it, and they don't want to be discriminated against, so they're setting up their own banks to give them the money they need to develop their economies. And so it's going to be called the BRICS Bank, or some name to that effect. And people have been asking me, what do I think about it? Well, look, on one level, I'm sympathetic. It's quite true that the banks based in North America, Western Europe, and Japan have always favored those regions where they are based, where most of their investors live, etc., etc. So it's normal, natural, and utterly no surprise that when the BRICS these other countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, have finally acquired the wealth and had they enjoyed the economic growth that they have, that they would begin to try to create institutions that are more friendly to them. Perfectly sensible, no problem at all in my mind, is long overdue. But I think it's important to understand that this is a national change. It's a change in who is going to be lending to whom in terms of what countries are going to be creating the institutions to lend to what countries. It doesn't change the class structure, neither in the Western Europe, North America, or Japan, nor in the BRICS countries. It's still going to be the same kind of bank, unless things change in ways nobody has suggested, the same kind of bank lending to businesses to hire more people, in other words, to reproduce the kind of corporate structures in the third world, the model for which is what happened in the first world, in Europe, North America, and Japan. Since we are critical here on this program of what modern corporations have done in the developed world, it's not so thrilling to know that now more of that is going to happen also in the third world. We understand, we're sympathetic, but to deal with the fundamental problems of capitalism, the BRICS are not a step in that direction. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've come to the end of the time we have for today. I want to thank you again, and I want to close today by inviting you, as I did at the beginning of last week. If you know of any radio station that might be interested in carrying this program, we now have about 35 and we're looking to grow. Please get in touch with us. If you're interested in having me come to your part of the country to give a talk, please get in touch with us. You are wonderful in providing us with the materials, with questions. If you can provide us with venues for the program and for me, all the better for all of us. Thank you again for your attention. I look forward to speaking with you again next week. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.